This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. In June, the Federal Department of Education announced that the number of homeless students in the U.S. exceeded 1 million for the first time. But getting hard numbers and real data can be difficult. What we do have are stories, like the story of KG from New London.
It was very hard trying to find resources and to finding shelters that were able to take you in and that were able to let you stay for however long you needed. There's really not many resources that was out there for me that was where I was able to call and say, hey, I need help. Yeah, there's 211, but it's not out there in the community where young kids need to. Maybe some of them are scared, and we don't really have the resources right now where it's okay, where people can be like, it's okay, that this is a good place for you to stay, and you can get on your feet.
That's audio from a panel discussion about youth homelessness from CTN, the Connecticut Network. Now, often these young people are from minority groups. Some are LGBT. Many have come out of the foster or juvenile justice system. 50% don't have a high school diploma. Today, Where We Live, a look at our state's population of homeless youth and what's being done to solve this problem. Also, as nationwide numbers of the entire homeless population went down, Connecticut actually has seen a rise in the last year, according to the Connecticut Coalition to End Homelessness. Today, Where We Live, we're talking about homelessness in our state. Later, we'll hear about a recent memorial service for homeless people who died in 2013. We're going to focus on the young population to start, though. How do you think we can support our homeless youth? Call us at 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. You can email where we live at WNPR.org. You can tweet us at where we live. I want to bring in first Alicia Woodsby, who's Deputy Executive Director of the Partnership for Strong Communities, and Stacey Violante-Cote, who's attorney for the Center for Children's Advocacy. I want to welcome them in to talk about this new study, Invisible No More, Creating Opportunities for Youth Who Are Homeless. Welcome to Where We Live. Thank you both for joining me.
Thank you for having us.
Yes, thank you.
So, first of all, you were mentioning that the young woman we heard off the top, KG from New London, was a success story. Maybe you can just start a little bit with her story.
So, KG was a wonderful speaker for us at our forum last week on youth homelessness. She's a young person who came out of the child welfare system. And because she did not have the requisite amount of educational programming to be able to stay in the child welfare system, she separated from there and went through quite a bit of family violence and domestic violence before she connected with a particular agency in our state called The Connection, who is providing services to young adults who have separated from the child welfare system, and provided some counseling, some housing services, as well as access to mental health care and planning for education and employment. So she was really able to come and talk to people about how, with the help of this program, she was able to get back on her feet and talk a lot about the work she's doing now and her interest in helping young people of her situation. And really was able to show us how, with supports and services, she could come out of that low point in her life to a higher point.
Well, what we want to start with is hear a bit more about some of the stories that you've gathered from young people in our state who are homeless. This report, Invisible No More, talks with them. About 100 young people were interviewed. Maybe you can just tell us a little bit more about what was in this survey, what exactly this report was about.
So I think we learned a lot from the survey. There were over 200 questions. We did structured interviews. We did semi-structured interviews. We also interviewed key informants. I think some of the most compelling information that came from the study was really the high levels of trauma, instability, victimization, vulnerability, abuse among the population. Their exposure, the modal number of trauma that they experienced was 5 traumatic events, and that being the incarceration of a close family member or friend. 33% had experienced rape. Over 50% had experienced being attacked without a weapon. There were a significant amount of early and unsafe sexual experiences. So over 23% of the kids had actually had their first sexual intercourse age 12 or under. So that was pretty striking for us to see, and high suicidal, high suicide ideation among the a quarter of the kids.
So how did you find these roughly 100 kids that you talked to?
We actually worked through street outreach workers who were trained through IRB training to the research protocol, and they went out and identified kids in Bridgeport, Lower Fairfield County, New London, New Haven, and Hartford. And they went out on the streets and through the runaway and homeless youth programs and other youth programs where they're likely to find these kids, and then worked through these kids to help them identify other kids that they knew that were also experiencing homelessness.
When you say homelessness and you're talking about young people, it's something that maybe a lot of people don't understand or can't really picture exactly what that is. If they're homeless, where are they living? Where do you find them?
It's a great question, because one of the big things we learned was that these kids don't conceptualize homelessness the same way that adults conceptualize homelessness. So it's a very creative method at getting at the fact that they do not have housing stability. They'll talk about bouncing around or sleeping on other people's couches. We found that some kids are sleeping in apartment building hallways. So they don't see themselves as homeless. And something really interesting that we discovered was Waterbury actually went out and counted 40 youth in 2 days. And they said their biggest, and they were all unaccompanied homeless youth, they said their biggest challenge right now was education. So they didn't necessarily see the fact that the housing instability, the homelessness, was a factor that was a major challenge in their life.
What are some other things that you drew from this report that you think our listeners should know about? Because, again, this is a population that we don't – it's called Invisible No More. We don't think about very much.
So first I would like to recognize Dr. Derek Gordon, who from Yale Consultation Center performed the study and the report, and who did a wonderful job of really conceptualizing who these kids are and how we're going to be able to find them and how we're going to be able to understand their needs. So Dr. Gordon's report, which is available online, is very illuminating in that. Number one, it tells us, as Alicia mentioned, about the traumatic experiences these young people have had, about their need and identification for education, and the fact that they themselves do not recognize that moving from couch to couch, staying in different people's houses from week to week, is actually homelessness. Mm-hmm. What we also came to understand is that of the few services available in this state, the kids themselves were not always aware of services available. So that in Connecticut, we have some crisis services for this population, but only in four cities. We have them in Bridgeport, Meriden. We have them in New Haven and Lower Fairfield County. We have none in Hartford. And one of the things that we thought was that we would have a difficult time finding these youth in Hartford. Mm-hmm. But we're thankful to programs like Public Allies and Hands on Hartford that were able to donate some staff time. And they found, of all the programs, the most number of youth for this study in the Hartford area. So that one of the things we want people to know is these youth exist all over the state. We were limited in our ability to capture these youth, given the number of folks who we had available to interview. But we were getting calls from rural parts of the state, from all over the northeast corner, the northwest corner, saying, we have some youth who we think would be good for your study.
It sounds to me like what you're both saying is it's a little bit hard to capture what this population is. I mean, can you give us some sort of broad numbers? Can you extrapolate from what you did find and say, there are this many young people living, you know, couch to couch, homeless in the state right now?
I think what we can say, we can't give an exact number, and I don't think that we can fairly extrapolate at this point, but I think what this study did was answer the number one question that we hear from policymakers and the public, which is that does this really exist? Is this really happening? Not in Connecticut. We know nationally that there's counts all over the country that are starting to develop. This was our first step in going out and quickly finding 100 kids and saying, this is their experience, this is what they're going through. How can we use what we've learned from this to design a methodology in the state where we can use multiple methods to annually figure out how to count these kids in a much more accurate way. We have some data from street outreach, so we know that over 5,000 kids sought food from street outreach. We know that the Department of Education identified 3,000 kids who are homeless. DCF has talked about 1,000 kids who ran away within a year. So we have these figures, but none of them give us a real clear, comprehensive picture.
Can we come back to the Department of Education piece of this very quickly? Something we've talked about on the program before is the sad fact that our educational system, our schools around the state, are seen as a primary source of food for a number of people in our state. That the first meal that kids get on a Monday at school is often the first meal that they've had for several days because over the weekend they didn't eat at all. What more can we glean from the educational system in all this? Are we talking about students who are integrated into the educational system but somehow just don't have a place to live?
I'd say we have both. We have some students who were separated from the educational system, and that came out in our study. We had about 32% of the students had either dropped out of school or were no longer in school. Mm-hmm. And then we also, sadly, had about 12% whose school told them they could no longer attend school. And that's very concerning. One of the audience members in our forum last week pointed out that federal law does allow homeless students to stay in their school while they're moving around. So
I just want to
get concerned about that.
I want to make sure I understand. The schools are telling them they can't attend school because why?
It's often because there's a question about whether or not the student is staying in the district, living in the district, and maybe perhaps a disagreement about whether or not the student is homeless. Federal law does say if a student is homeless, they're entitled to stay in their school district. And it also allows them to stay and go through a process to disagree with the school district. But what we know is that students often don't know about that right and don't know how to actualize that right.
And many of the staff also are not fully informed about the rights of the students. So as Stacy said, there was a 29-30% dropout rate among these kids. 25% were in special education. And the mobility rate and the housing instability, we know from multiple other experiences that leads to major gaps in learning. And kids are really failing. They're also experiencing stigma in the school system, which is preventing them from going, and transportation issues. So even if they are allowed to remain in the school system, they have difficulty getting there.
Quickly, yeah.
One thing I would say, though, is for the kids who were still in school, that was a very strong connection in their life. So when we asked them about who was important in their life, if they were still in school, a teacher, a counselor was giving them guidance, education, sometimes money for food, sometimes helping them find clothing, sometimes helping them identify a place they could stay. At our forum last week, Superintendent Clocko from Torrington Public Schools talked about driving down the street, seeing one of her students walking, driving him to a family shelter and convincing the family shelter that he should be able to stay. So for those kids who are connected to school, that connection is vital.
We're talking with representatives from the Center for Children's Advocacy and the Partnership for Strong Communities about a new report called Invisible No More, Creating Opportunities for Youth Who Are Homeless. When we come back from our break, we're going to be talking more about the homeless population in Connecticut, broadening out the discussion a little bit. And we also are going to hear from you at 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. You can email wherewelive@wnpr.org, or you can tweet us at wherewelive. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're talking about the problem of homelessness in the state. It's a problem that has actually gotten worse over the last year. One of the things we've been talking about so far is the youth homeless population. It's in a new study, Invisible No More. We've been talking with Alicia Woodsby from the Partnership for Strong Communities and Stacey Violante-Cote from the Center for Children's Advocacy. I want to bring into our conversation Lisa Tepper-Bates, who's Executive Director of the Connecticut Coalition to End Homelessness. She joins us by phone today. And Lisa, good to have you back on the show. Thank you so much for joining us here on Where We Live.
Thank you very much for having me today.
I'm wondering, before we get into some of the work that you folks have been doing, if you might react to this study that we heard about youth homelessness. What do you think that this tells us overall about the problem of homelessness in Connecticut?
Well, John, first of all, I'd like to say that I think both Stacey and Alicia have done remarkable work in leading this important effort to get our arms around this problem of young people who are homeless and not living in appropriate circumstances, whether shelter or otherwise, in Connecticut. We have more work to do, as we've discussed, to get a really good idea of the scope of that, where these folks are, and how we can better help them. So my hat is off to both of your guests today and to Dr. Gordon for their good work so far. And CCEH is really pleased to be working with them as a sponsor of this effort. Young people, we need to remember, are not just those below the age of 18, but also those who are between 18 and 24 years old. Those are youth in terms of the way we look at the homeless population. And, John, during our last point in time count, which was last January, and that is a sort of census of homelessness in our state that we do one night each year, we found that 25% of the families who were homeless were headed by a young parent who was 24 years old at the outside, between 18 and 24. There are very special challenges that we need to learn to address to help those young parents to plot their best way out of homelessness and to stability for themselves and their children.
So that our listeners understand what you're talking about, when we mentioned this earlier study about youth homelessness, this was essentially a survey of some 198, actually, young people who were surveyed around the state. When you talk about a point in time count, Lisa, what exactly is it you're talking about?
That's right. Thanks, John, for that. Every year across the nation, on one night in every community, every state, there is an effort to count those who are homeless in shelters, and in every other year, those who are on the streets and unsheltered. And the reason for this, John, is to give us a good idea at a point in time of what homelessness looks like in our state. We know how many people we serve in shelters in a year, but there's more information that we can collect by getting that sense of how many people really are homeless. And that includes children, that includes single adults. That's the entire population that we are trying to get a good count of. So that count is coming up again this year in January on the 29th. And we did it last year, as I mentioned, and found some important information there. We had over 800 children in Connecticut on one night who were homeless, either sheltered or unsheltered. Even more disturbing, of course, are the ones who are not even in an appropriate shelter. What is a challenge to us, and we've talked about a little bit earlier in your show, is getting a really solid count on those young people who are not in families, who are out on the streets and not appropriately sheltered. And we will be working with Stacy and Alicia and Dr. Gordon to try and get a better count of those young people so that we can better advocate for the services they need.
But beyond the number of young people in the state, Lisa, I'm wondering if you can just talk about where we are headed or have been heading trend-wise in Connecticut. Are we seeing more homelessness in our state, and how does that match national trends?
Right. Well, if I can, I'll start with the good news. And the good news is that we have had a pretty tremendous decrease in the homelessness of veterans. And that's a really good thing, John. About a 25% decrease in veteran homelessness from 2009 to our point in time count last January. So that's a really good trend, and we hope that that will continue. Where Connecticut, though, is encountering a real challenge is with regard to other forms of homelessness. And I'm sorry to say, John, that we are a bit bucking the national trend, which is reduction of homelessness, where we have seen increases in Connecticut. And in particular in Connecticut, we have seen an important increase in our homeless population who are unsheltered. That number increased by a third between 2011 and 2013. And that's not the direction that we want to see it going.
I guess I have to ask you, though, why is that happening? What do we know about the reasons why Connecticut is unfortunately bucking a national trend of improvement?
Yeah, I think, John, it's a product of a couple of things. Almost every year, we have the same number of people in our shelters because Connecticut's shelters tend to run at about 100% capacity. So you're not going to see a lot of change in those numbers. And what that means is that if there are conditions, which I'm afraid to say there are in Connecticut, that mean people are having a tough time making ends meet. And if they do fall into homelessness and they can't get into a shelter, that's where we're going to see an increase. And, John, I don't need to tell you that Connecticut, unfortunately, has one of the weakest recoveries from the recession in the United States. And that means that there are people who lost jobs, spent down their savings, and have not been able to get a new job and recover.
Now, I just want to...
I think that's...
Yeah. Well, I just want to break in very quickly and just let our listeners know we're talking today on the program about homelessness in our state. As Lisa Tepper-Bates from the Connecticut Coalition to End Homelessness just said, we're bucking a national trend of improvement in that area, actually more homeless people in our state. We've also been looking at a new study about youth homelessness in Connecticut. You can join us at 860-275-7266. We'll take your calls in just a moment. Lisa, before we move on, I just want to ask one more thing, and it has to do with this 100% capacity in shelters. Many people would listen to that number and say, well, obviously we need to have more temporary shelters for people. But whenever I've discussed the problem of homelessness with experts in the field, they say, well, yes, but, and there's always a big but. Where do you come down on this, about the need for more placements for people in shelters?
Right, and that's a very fair question that you ask, John. I think the way we want to look at it, however, is a little bit different, and that is to say we need to help people get out of shelter more quickly. Generally speaking, it's much better for whether it's a single adult or a family with children. Shelter is certainly a superior alternative to being homeless on the street, but shelter is no place to live. We want people to be able to move through shelter quickly and back into appropriate permanent housing as quickly as possible. And by helping every individual, whether it's a single adult or parents with children, to get into appropriate permanent housing quickly, that is how we can better use our existing stock of emergency shelter. And what that means, John, is people should not be spending 90 days or 120 days or 6 months in an emergency shelter. Our goal nationally is to get that down to 30 days or less, if at all possible. And that is a challenge, but it's a challenge that we need to face. And there are parts of our state in Connecticut that are getting better and better at understanding how to help people move that next step back to permanent and appropriate housing.
Stacey?
I would add to what Lisa's saying in that there is a bit of a difference for youth, young people who are right now not able to access the safety of shelters in all of the places of Connecticut. So we would like to see an increase in the capacity of those immediate crisis services for young people and be able to get them connected to services to better understand whether they can go back home and or do they need some transitional type support services to move to eventually toward a more permanent housing situation in the way that Lisa's discussing.
Alicia, do kids need a different sort of shelter, a different sort of housing environment temporarily than adults do?
By kids, you're talking about
young people,
homeless youth.
Yes, exactly.
That's one of the things that we're hoping to learn and design through this task force planning process that we'll engage in over the next 8 to 10 months. What are the best models? How do we break these kids down by looking at state data, working with providers, what we've learned from the study, into subpopulations that we can look at and say, what are the risk factors? What are the needs? What type of a model would work best for each population? But in general, we need a crisis response. And we don't have that right now. There are no safe places for these kids to go other than the very limited ones that Stacey spoke about earlier today. So one of the big priorities we have as far as policy and practice recommendations go is to reinstate the funding for the homeless youth program. It was actually passed in Connecticut General Statutes in 2010. And it would have established two regional teams that would have engaged in that street outreach. It would have helped identify these kids, provided drop-in centers, respite and host home options for short-term crisis assessment and to help support their immediate safety needs, and have some limited transitional housing options to help support them for a little bit a longer term to get them connected to the services that they need. So we see that the particular vulnerability, exploitation, and victimization of these kids coupled with the invisibility necessitates a real crisis response.
That our listeners understand, it got passed into law in 2010 but has not been implemented?
It was funded, and a request for proposal was developed, and providers were actually selected. And then when the recession hit, the money was pulled back.
So how much money are we talking about?
We're talking about $1 million for that program, which is really a drop in the bucket if you think about the systems that these kids are currently utilizing. And the study really illuminated that for us. So over half of these kids have been arrested. Half of these kids have had family contact with DCF. So they're in the juvenile justice system. They're in the child welfare system. They're receiving mental health services. We're paying for them already. And their trajectory, what we know nationally from the research, is pretty abysmal. So if there's no intervention or prevention early on, these kids will end up utilizing these systems for long periods of time, and they'll rely on SSI, SSDI, housing support.
So $1 million to fund this program and to help how many kids?
$1 million initially. We don't know exactly how many kids that will serve. I don't know if we can make estimates on that, but
I'm only asking because we have lots of lawmakers who listen to the program. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking about the problem of youth homelessness and homelessness generally in our state. We're talking with Alicia Woodsby, who's executive director of the Partnership for Strong Communities. Stacey Violante-Cote is attorney at the Center for Children's Advocacy. And we also have on the line Lisa Tepper-Bates, who's executive director of the Connecticut Coalition to End Homelessness. We're going to take your calls in just a moment at 860-275-7266. But I want to turn to our next guest. Nate Fox is project supervisor at Hands-On Hartford. He joins us in studio as well today. Nate, thanks so much for being here. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, John.
And also want to welcome in Sarah Ratchford, who's a member of the Faces of Homelessness Speakers Bureau. She's also a staff writer for Beat of the Street. Sarah, so good to see you. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Sarah, I'm wondering if we can just ask you a little bit about your story. When you go around speaking as a member of this Speakers Bureau, what story are you telling them?
I tell them the story of my experience of being homeless for 2 years and how traumatizing it was for me. But I also know that it was something that I had to go through so that I could speak about it and try to do things about it. That's why I speak at different places. And I'm also also involved in other organizations like Journey Home and also the affordable housing. I'm also on there as a consumer. So you really, if you've lived it, those are the best people to go to, the people who have actually lived it and have been in different shelters and have utilized different systems and so forth. And Hands-On Hartford was a big, big deal for me, big deal. And also the Connecticut Coalition to End Homelessness was a big deal for me as well.
So why were you homeless? You've probably obviously thought about this, broken this down in your own mind. You told your story. Why did you end up homeless for 2 years?
It was a long process. It was coming on for quite a while. Yeah. Jobs phasing out, positions phasing out one after another. And it was coming, you know, one after another, raising a son, being a single parent, and doing the best that I could and really trying hard to do everything that I could. Working, you know, not relying on the system, and one thing after another. One job would phase out after another. A position or a company would – it was one thing after another, and it finally happened. And I tried to put it off as long as I could, and like I said, I was a single parent. I had a son he went through college. I was by myself, and it was hard. So I downsized thinking that would work. But here comes another phase out. So it was one thing after another, and it was traumatizing.
Where did you live during the 2 years? What was your life like?
Shelter to shelter. I stayed with friends. It was difficult because I'd never relied on anyone before. I was always someone who even worked one job, two jobs, and did what I could. And I also stayed out of town for a while. I think I was in maybe four or five different shelters. Mm-hmm. So I know what it is to do the shelter shuffle is what they call it. And it was traumatizing. It was really, really, really hard. But I knew I had to go through. I didn't know why I was going through what I was going through, but I knew it was for a reason. That's why I have to give back now. That's why I speak every chance I get. I speak and tell my story, because if people will say, I think I know what it is,
yeah,
because I have a friend that has a sister that has a cousin that lives down the street, it gets really watered down. So people who really have been through it and tell their story are the ones that really can help make a difference.
Well, what you just said, I think I know what it is because, and
exactly.
Then somebody follows up that story. So what's the thing that most of the rest of us who thankfully have not had to sleep shelter to shelter, what's the thing we don't get? I mean, what's something that we don't understand about what it's like to not have a place of your own?
When you go in there, you're already beaten down. You're already stressed. I had major stress and depression issues because I was tired of taking one step forward and getting a kickback five steps and two steps and 10 steps back. So after a while, it wears you down. Everyone has a breaking point, everyone. And you just don't know where it is. You just don't know. I was always a strong person, but eventually I got worn down. And I saw some horror stories at the shelters. One was at the one shelter that had allowed people to keep children in the family unit. And the woman had four children. And her son was, you know, he's a tall boy. He's a big guy, 12 years old. He was staying in the shelter up where the families lived, where there were other young girls and so forth. Finally, she had to have him leave and go stay with her sister. And that broke him apart. That broke her. He would come to the shelter in the morning and cry on her shoulders before he went to school because he couldn't stay with his mother. He had to stay with a relative. So that ripped him up, and that ripped her up. So that was one instance that I saw, and that was horrible. That was horrible, you know. So I can't believe we only have one really true family shelter in the city of Hartford. I can't understand that.
Mm. Nate, I know you want to jump in. I guess I'm wondering if you can maybe talk a bit about how typical the story that we're hearing now is from what you deal with every day.
I think it's typical and it's atypical too, and that's another thing that we – as the Faces of Homelessness Speakers Bureau really try to emphasize, which is that homelessness is extremely varied. There's no one-size-fits-all. I think Sarah's story really highlights the fact that it can happen to anyone, and that's something that I think a lot of people don't stop and think about. And we also really try to emphasize that there's really no one most deserving kind of homelessness. A lot of the time there's, you know, bickering around who deserves help, you know, people who are actively using or who are suffering from job loss, you know, who gets the services, who gets the attention. We really try to go out and emphasize that everyone deserves a home at the end of the day.
But what is so heartbreaking about Sarah's story, though, and so very true, is that every situation is different. And if you have children, that presents a whole unique set of circumstances that gets back to this earlier conversation. If you're bringing children with you, that has a completely different dynamic, and I'm sure it exacerbates the problem because you're not just taking care of yourself, you're trying to take care of other young people, Sarah.
Yes, I was grateful. I was grateful that my son had, you know, he, like I said, he had graduated from college, he had moved on. I was truly, truly grateful that I didn't have a child with me. And I would see other women with their children. And like I said, the one woman that had her younger children, and then she had her son who was 12 but looked like a grown man. He stayed for a while. He actually stayed for a while. But after a while, he had to go. And that hurt him because he was homeless, and then he was out without his mother at the same time.
And Stacey, you're nodding your head here. This sounds like a story that you've heard before.
We get calls all the time of young people who have been separated from their family because their family is homeless, and either they were in a shelter, as Sarah talked about, and the young person had to be separated from them, and or the family is staying with multiple people, and those people cannot accommodate the young person. So the young person is either staying from couch to couch to couch or doing some of these more unsafe situations where they're sleeping in hallways or staying in cars or staying out in the open. We hear about that quite often.
Yeah, we have one of the members of the Faces of Homelessness Speakers Bureau is a 20-year-old male who went through that exact situation. His family's house burned down when he was 15 or 16, and they ended up splitting up and going and living with different friends. And after a while, the friend who his dad was staying with could no longer accommodate him, so he had to go and stay with some other people. He's now living in transitional housing, which is a 2-year housing program, but he's staying with adults, you know, 30, 40, 50-year-olds. And here's this 20-year-old basically kid who's in there, extremely resilient. I mean, you don't always find people who can really rise up in that, in those circumstances, but it just goes to show the limited options that are out there for people.
Go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to add, because I think it's important to clarify when I said we don't know how many it will serve.
Yeah.
It's because it's a limited amount of dollars, and the state has great flexibility in how they're going to choose to designate those dollars across those different service categories.
Yeah.
So they could choose, you know, a certain number of respite beds, a certain number of transitional housing options. They did base the fiscal analysis off of about 367 kids they cited in that analysis, but we really see it as a pilot program to get us started and give us a better handle on what are the numbers, how many kids are utilizing what service.
I just want to get to a phone call or two here at 860-275-7266 as we talk about the problem of homelessness in our state today. John is calling from Kensington. Hi, John. Go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Hi. I was just telling your lady, I consider myself so conservative that I'm a liberal. And when I listen to this, I have two things. I feel like one foot is in boiling water, one foot is in freezing cold water. On average, I'm okay. We have enough money to blow up foreign countries. There shouldn't be anyone that's homeless, no child in Connecticut. But all I hear is studies and surveys and executive directors and lobbyists and spokesmen. We should stop all the surveys and studies and start helping people and get all this duplication out of the system.
Well, John, first of all, I think you're probably saying something that a lot of people think about this, but let's before we take our break here, let's try to get some reality around this. Lisa Tepper Bates, you know, you work at trying to get funding for programs like the ones that we're talking about. And in our last segment, I really want to get to some solutions here. But you just heard John from Kensington. He says, look, we have a million surveys and studies and point-in-time counts, and we've got different people with different programs trying to help, and we still have this big problem. How do we get at it a little bit more directly?
Well, and I first of all want to thank your caller, because I think he's right. We need always to focus on that service at the ground level for the people in need. So he's exactly right about that. But what it takes so that we can make the best use of every dollar, John, and I know about that challenge because I ran a shelter for families before I came to the Connecticut Coalition to End Homelessness. And all of our members are those providers. But to help them make the most of every dollar, we have to have an understanding of what the scope of the problems that we're trying to solve, what it is. And that's why these studies. And we need to help our providers to plot their way towards that best use. And, John, I just want to speak quickly to the fact that Sarah gave such an articulate representation of how very, very difficult it is to be homeless, whether you're single or a family. And I think that really underscores, when we talk about resource use, we need to put our resources into helping people exit shelter to appropriate permanent housing. We need to not focus on keeping them in shelter. We need to focus on getting them housed. And that's a different way to look at the problem. And to your caller's point, that's a lot of what the Connecticut Coalition is trying to do with our member agencies. Help them understand, how do we move through shelter back to housing and have that as our focus? Because that's what we need to do, and that's what we owe to the people of Connecticut who are homeless on our streets and in our shelters.
Just to jump off that, I think Sarah's story and what Lisa was just saying also really highlights the fact that we have oftentimes dealt with homelessness in a sort of one-size-fits-all kind of way. And there's a lot of work going on right now and a lot of what we're talking about today trying to better target the way in which we work with people. So I knew Sarah pretty much the entire time she was going through homelessness. And from the start, I could see that she was someone who was really had a lot of strengths and abilities to get out of this quickly, but she floundered because there was nothing there to really help get her out immediately. It took 2 years for those resources to come along. And so I think we need to better figure out, you know, when there's someone who's in Sarah's shoes, how to make that happen from day one instead of waiting 2 whole years.
But I really want to pull apart something else you said earlier, too, which is, I think, an important point to make. You want to be able to target people who have different needs very individually. But you also don't want to make value judgments about the different types of people who are homeless. Because just in today's program, I've heard about people who have a long-term illness and they end up homeless. People whose house is burned down, they end up homeless. They lose job after job after job, they end up homeless. Some people have serious mental health issues. Some people are serious abusers of illegal drugs. And if we group everyone into one group, we're not going to be able to help anyone. But if we say we're going to help these people and not those people, that's probably not going to be the right thing to do either.
Well, John, if I could speak to that.
I just want to have Sarah jump in really quickly. She's looking right at me and she wanted to talk.
what I can say is that a lot of times people, they're trying as hard as they can with everything they have. And that can drive you to those mental illnesses, and you have a breakdown, and people understand you can be the strongest person, but like I said, everyone has a breaking point. And if the harder you try, and things you keep getting kicked in the face and directed to nowhere and given empty promises, after a while, you snap. The strongest person can snap. So you see these people walking around sometimes and you think that they don't want to do anything with their lives and whatever. They've been kicked in the face a lot of times. They just have been kicked in the face. And you can only take so much.
We're going to have to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation about homelessness in Connecticut. We're hearing from Sarah Ratchford. We also heard from Nathan Fox from Hands on Hartford, Lisa Tepper-Bates from the Connecticut Coalition to End Homelessness. We have with us as well Stacey Violante-Cote, who is from the Center for Children's Advocacy, Alicia Woodsby, who is from the Partnership for Strong Communities. We have some of your phone calls as well at 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, 173 acres of office space in Simsbury is up for sale. It's formerly the Hartford, but now what's it going to be? Decades ago, many corporations moved from cities to the suburbs into sprawling campuses surrounded by trees. Now many of those corporate suburban office parks sit vacant or near vacant. We're going to try to find out what's happening with them on the next Where We Live. Today we're talking about the problem of homelessness in Connecticut. It is a wide-ranging problem, from youth homelessness to a general homeless population that is growing in the state, bucking a national trend that's heading in the right direction. We're going to go to the phones quickly. Derek is calling from Windsor. Hi, Derek. Go ahead.
Hey, John, let me tell you something, man. This is outrage. And I listen to everyone speaking and sounding kind of Pollyannish about this whole issue. This is nothing to kind of sound that kind of way about. I hear oftentimes America, the richest country in the world. Man, we better stop saying that, you know, John. Because the richest country in the world, nobody's supposed to be homeless, my friend. And let me just ask you on the panel, isn't the church can make a difference because they collect a lot of money? We don't have to leave everything on government.
Yes, and Derek, first of all, I appreciate your phone call very much, and I think you are right on many counts there. What Derek's asking about is something I want to put to Nathan Fox. Can churches help? And how are they helping?
Definitely, and I think it goes back to the prior caller's comment as well, which is about, you know, getting involved and just diving in. And Hands on Hartford does a lot of work with congregations from the greater Hartford area. Our Faces of Homelessness Speakers Bureau, one of our primary audiences is faith groups. So we go out a lot and speak to these different groups and really try to talk about how people can get involved, really plug them into different service projects and opportunities. I really encourage anyone to go on to the Hands on Hartford website if you're in the greater Hartford area to look for those sorts of opportunities.
Before we move on, I just do have to ask you, though, one of the things we wanted to talk about is you held a memorial service for homeless people in our area who died, some 43 people over 2013. And, you know, at the end of the year, we look back on all the famous, important people whose names we know who died. And this is an opportunity to look back at people whose faces we probably don't know that well.
Yeah, it's a ceremony that we hold every year, unfortunately. I've been involved for the past 3 years now. And like you said, it's an opportunity to acknowledge and honor those who have passed, who may not get a traditional ceremony. And also it's really a way to articulate the end result of a lot of these things that we're talking about the trauma, about the health conditions. 43 this year was, I think, triple the number that we came up with last year. And granted, that may be, you know, due to our inability to find everyone last year, but it's, I think, also really speaks to the growth of this issue.
So we have about 5 minutes left, and I want to just very quickly, and we're going to have to be fast, go around our panel here and ask about sort of next things or solutions, something we need to take away from this. And Sarah, you were talking during the break. What's something we should make sure we mention here?
Focus on opening up another homeless family shelter. A family shelter in the city of Hartford is greatly needed. We only have one true family shelter. We need at least one more, at least.
At least one more.
At least one more.
Family shelter in the city of Hartford. Stacey, how about you? I mean, what are some things we want to take away from this conversation and things that you think that we need to do next?
I would say two things, John. Number one, we need more crisis services for these young people who have no place to go, no immediate crisis mediation services for these families that separate the kids from their families. And the second thing I would say is that we need to keep these kids connected to their education. That is the way out. That is their source of support and a source of important connection.
Alicia, how about you?
I think Stacey covered the solutions related to the youth population. So I would just say overall, we haven't really talked about the housing affordability crisis in general.
Let's talk about it briefly, yeah.
The fact that we have an over 90,000 unit shortage of affordable housing needed for those who are at the lowest incomes in our state. And we have about 1,000 people who are extremely low income right now, 100,000 people in Connecticut who are extremely low income, spending 50% or more of their income on rent, which makes them severely cost burdened.
And 30% is what we're supposed to be spending about.
Yes, 30% would make it affordable, anything over that. So if they're spending more than 50%, they are one unanticipated expense away from falling into homelessness. So we really need to accelerate our work around developing deeply subsidized affordable housing for those individuals so that we can avoid more folks falling into homelessness.
And we've talked about this issue an awful lot on the program here, but when we talk about affordable housing in the state, I mean, what do we mean? Are we talking about going back to the world of building large-scale affordable housing complexes where a whole bunch of low-income people live together, or is it something different?
No, there are multiple models, but mixed-income housing is where you can have affordable units actually in market-rate units. So you can have them, you wouldn't know which was affordable and which was market rate. There are subsidies that could be used that could be scattered site in rental units all across the state that could help people to afford their housing. There's something called permanent supportive housing, which is for people with more chronic and complex needs. And we are way behind in what we need in order to meet the demand for people who are chronically homeless, who permanent supportive housing is really the best solution for those folks.
And Lisa Tepper Bates from the Connecticut Coalition to End Homelessness, I'll give you the last minute here, and we do have about 1 minute left for you to give a last word.
Great. Well, I'm going to echo Alicia's comments about the need for us to address the terrible gap in affordable housing in Connecticut, but also, John, for us to use our existing resources more efficiently and more effectively to help every person who's homeless to exit homelessness to the right kind of housing, whether it's permanent supportive housing, affordable housing, or even market rate housing with some help to get out of shelter and into that market rate housing.
I want to thank all of our panelists. I assume that all of you have different ways in which we can get involved. And what we're going to do is put more information on our website, WNPR.org, associated with today's show, so you can continue this conversation. We would love to hear your stories. And we would also love to get you in contact with some services that might help some people. I want to thank everyone for joining us today. Our program is produced by Tucker Ives and Lydia Brown. The executive producer is Katie Talarski. I'm John Dankosky. This is Where We Live.
PR.org.